Hi, everyone. Good evening. Welcome to the broadcast. So tonight's webinar is about a specific approach to therapy, one that over the past several years has really taken off, and a lot of people are practicing it, and it has a very specific outline for its participants. In fact, to call yourself a dialectical behavioral therapy program, you have to get certification, and you have to practice it to the nth degree. You can't just talk about it as something that you believe in or espouse. It has specific outlines, specific behavior, specific even hours that individuals who are setting up these types of programs have to have. But like all webinars, part of what I'm going to try to do tonight for all of us is talk about the topic at hand, which tonight is DBT, and then how can we learn from it? What's its application more broadly in our lives as parents and as people? So with that, let me get into tonight's webinar on dialectical behavioral therapy. So the history and the foundation. First of all, this is a therapy that was developed by a woman by the name of Dr. Marsha Linehan. And not only did Dr. Linehan develop this theory, but she also suffered significantly from mood disorders and impulses for self-destruction. So she comes from that background. As a clinician, she was observing her colleagues, her peers, those she supervised. She was observing the amount of burnout and frustration that clinicians were feeling when working with specific populations who had very little progress in outcomes. That's probably the first application for us tonight, right? If a clinician working with a client or a patient can become frustrated or burnt out, exhausted by the process, how much more easy would it be or even expected for a parent to experience that when they're living with somebody like this? Specifically, she started it with the treatment of borderline personality disorders, which are notorious for being resistant to the process, right? Part of the dilemma, part of the game that gets set up for the clinician or for the parent is you're going to lose. I'm going to find a way to make you lose. And part of it comes from a place of course, helplessness and powerlessness themselves, the unconscious process of I'm going to get you to experience the same kind of helplessness and powerlessness that I feel. I love this concept, although it doesn't come from Linehan. I love this concept that was shared with me years ago, this idea that with borderline patients, and I think this can have application to a lot of relationships, including most of our children, is this idea that in the end, you cannot win, but you can choose how to lose. And for me, that's been a very liberating concept, but I'm digressing a little bit. This now has expanded, the research and the data has expanded to include other populations, eating disorder, other mood disorders, addictions, compulsive behaviors, even traumatic brain injuries. And they're continuing to expand the research in this area. So we're seeing how it can become helpful for a lot of different diagnoses. It started off with cognitive behavioral therapy. It borrows from or starts with that seed of cognitive behavioral theory, but they've added to it. And they saw that patients were uncooperative because cognitive behavioral therapy does require a certain kind of cooperation. It does require the patient or the client to be invested in their work. And in many cases, the borderline client or the compulsive client, it's beyond any kind of rational control. So they've reduced it to a set of skills and ideas that can be effective with this population. It also borrows on Carl Rogers' humanistic theory, this unconditional positive regard for client. And most importantly, and this is something I don't often hear talked about when people talk about this, it's really based in a powerful and kind and loving therapeutic alliance. Right? Because these individuals have experienced at times in their life big T or little T traumas, because they experience their environment, their context is invalidating, in order to create the soil necessary for these seeds to be planted and to grow, to sprout, the therapeutic alliance is essential. In fact, so much of Linehan's theory, this is a great concept for all of us, so much of it, because it's reduced to skill building, there is a quality of it that's detached, that's not punitive. It's not about valuing it as right or wrong, good or bad, but rather about around a specific set of skills and tools. So when you talk about it in that context with those ideas, then you're not talking about a moral failing, if you will. Dialectics is the idea, the concept, the study of two seemingly opposite ideas that can be held together at the same time. One of the foundational ones of these is this first dialectic, which is people are doing their best and they can do better. And they, according to Linehan and her work, they need skills in order to do better, to avoid this self-harming, self-sabotaging, and to really regulate their emotional and cognitive world. It's they experience it as outside of their control. Like I said, it takes off from cognitive behavioral therapy, which looks at our the events in our lives, our interpretation of those events, and what drives us, what are our impulses from that. Like I said, it talks about skills therapy, so think assertiveness training, a really core principle. And this is in a lot of our therapies. This is in a lot of Evoke's curriculum. This is in a lot of my book, is this concept borrowed from Buddhist and Eastern philosophies of mindfulness, of being present with oneself, accepting what is. Mindfulness is a tool to learn how to feel in a more effective way. It steers us away from or suggests that we not try to avoid. And so many disorders, so many of the things that get us into trouble in our lives are about distracting ourselves. And it really is this distracting, this impulse to distract, whether it be from addictive behaviors, cutting on oneself, the drama that we create in our relationships. You could just go down the list of symptoms and mental health issues. This impulse to distract is really just an extension of our culture, right? Our Western culture says if it's uncomfortable, take a pill and make it go away, instead of leaning into it. Mindfulness practices suggest that we feel it more deeply. We feel it deeply. And that if it is a problem that needs addressing, that that's the way through it or to it. But if it's just something that we need to go through to feel, for example, grief, sadness, some kinds of pain, then we just let it pass through us. The dialectical of learning as a practitioner, as a parent, I think this is something that all of you have questions about. How can I balance validating my client or child, but at the same time encouraging and facilitating change? I think that's a very difficult balance. So many children will utter this idea, this phrase of my parents are saying something's wrong with me, that I'm bad. They don't accept me for who I am. And you're talking about kids who are compulsively using drugs and alcohol, you know, dangerous behavior, not functioning in relationships in life, not even safe in some instances. And so our concern, our worry for them is about their happiness, the quality of their life. That doesn't feel to us like a lack of acceptance, but it can be interpreted that way. So we try to find a balance, and part of the way that we do this is we, again, separate out the value-laden discussion and talk about it in terms of skill building. It's the same kind of concept or same kind of effect when we talk about and learn about alcoholism or addiction as a disease. Once you classify it as a disease, you lose that moral judgment, that rejection, that disdain for it. We don't have disdain or judgment for somebody who has cancer or who has asthma. Right? We don't have that kind of feeling. And so if we can reduce it to that same kind of effect when you talk about skill building. So in the borderline personality disorder research, where this was initially tested, they talked about this idea of the client being emotionally vulnerable, right? It's this out of control experience. stemming from invalidating experiences. Now, I cannot tell you how often I hear through one of our therapists, or I hear from sometimes directly from parents, that when I talk about some of this stuff, especially with something like this, that I get letters or emails or phone calls saying, Brad was blaming the parents and he's angry at us, especially because a lot of the research or language is around mothers. I'm just sharing with you what the diagnostic manual says and suggests, and it can be more subtle. And every individual doesn't have the same, even the genetic resiliency. So it's just part of being human. And in these cases, this experience of emotional invalidation has cemented itself in the brain circuitry. This can happen in the home. It can happen from friends. It can happen with teachers, therapists, others, adults in the lives of these individuals. But the main thing is this interaction, the transaction between the two results in this experience, in this incredibly exaggerated anxious attachment to others or lack of attachment to others. Also, that there's a reinforcement. This happens for all of us. There's a reinforcement for negative or aberrant behaviors, right? We sometimes reinforce those behaviors inadvertently that we would rather extinguish. But it's just like falling into the pattern with a child that's tantruming. When somebody's cutting on themselves, when somebody's becoming reactive, we walk on eggshells, right? We end up not telling the truth or not showing up assertively in those relationships. And so we reinforce those things. So that this is kind of the foundation of this. And then this is the outline. This is the treatment for it. First of all, like I said, dialectic, everything is connected to everything else. Opposites can be integrated together for a closer approximation of the truth. Change is constant and inevitable. So these are these ideas that it's a lot like looking at the gray, because in the borderline mindset, in the addictive mindset, it's black and white. It's either or. And in fact, one of the principal tools that most therapies teach and that some of our research has shown us is that parents identify this, they don't call it dialectic, but this idea of learning to erase these kinds of thinking errors is a foundational concept for them, one of the top skills or tools that they use, those that consider themselves successful post-treatment. So this is very common in a lot of therapies. There are three types of work that go into a dialectical behavioral therapy model. First of all, there's individual work with the therapist. During this, they use diary cards. They use the sessions to set goals, to talk about what are we going to work on, what skills are we going to practice this week. And they also prioritize, of course, with the more severely life-threatening behaviors taking the most precedence, so that you work that out with a therapist. Then there's skills group. Everybody that's participating in a DBT program has a skills group, focusing on four skill sets: mindfulness, interpersonal effectiveness. You know, think of assertiveness training. You know, how do you get what you want out of relationships in a more effective, more stable way? Emotional regulation, learning to tolerate uncomfortable emotions, and then distress tolerance. I guess that's the one that talks about learning to tolerate distressing emotions, and emotional regulation is how to organize your thoughts. How to make sure that they don't overwhelm you, that you're not overcome by them. Phone coaching can be a part of it. They don't use phone coaching in these programs to do extra therapy sessions. They focus on skill building, right? To remind the young person, the individual, to make use of a certain skill, to decide what skill might be used in the situation that they're dealing with. So I'm going to talk about the stages, but also within the stages, the various targets that they work on. In DBT, it creates lives worth living. Marriage, children, charity, everything. All goals have in common is the task of bringing problem behaviors resulting in harm under control. Stage one, moving from emotional shutdown to experiencing emotions. And within that stage, the first target is to reduce and eliminate life-threatening behaviors. So again, taking that hierarchical priority. And then second after that is to reduce behaviors that interfere with treatment. We would call that resistance. Even distracting behaviors. Target three is decrease behaviors that destroy the quality of life. Depression, phobias, eating disorders, and lack of friends. You know, for a lot of our parents, for a lot of our families, you're somewhere on that continuum between quality of life that is suffering so greatly, and in some cases, sadly, to actually life itself. And then target four is to learn skills. A lot of it is about refocusing one's mind, not becoming obsessed with negative aspects of one mind. It's not the same as distracting because we allow ourselves to feel, but it's not going down that negative spiral that all of us can relate to. There's a difference between feeling your grief and sadness and focusing on a negative self-thought or self-talk or experience that we're having that is painful or judgmental. So they learn to control attention. They learn to develop new relationships, you know, this interpersonal effectiveness. They learn to understand their emotions, to understand all the parts. All of these have skills to them. Understanding what triggers, understanding the interpretations like cognitive behavioral therapy, understanding the drives that come out of it. And then they learn through the practice, all these practices in the mindfulness practice, to tolerate pain without self-harm. So there's a bit of a reframe in there. But again, a lot of parents can benefit from this, right? I think I've been thinking about this week as I've been studying and reading and writing about attachment. In fact, tomorrow on our blog, there'll be a new blog that I wrote about attachment in the conference we had last week and what it looks like in therapy for professionals. And again, applying it to families. But the fact of the matter is we don't allow pain. We don't allow for failures. We don't value the struggle and the difficulty. I was talking to a colleague this week. We were talking about one of my children, one of my older children at an adult stage in their life, and how I didn't step in at a certain moment when they might be making, quote unquote, a mistake. And my colleague said to me, "I don't know how you did that. I don't know how you tolerated that." And it could have been a significant mistake. And I said, well, number one, I didn't want to alienate my child. I wanted to be a resource to them. And I don't know their journey. So not only did I assume that I might not know what the truth is, but they might need to go through something that teaches them something the same way that I learned. So I was going to try to be present with them. And so as parents, we can learn, ideally, we can develop a greater capacity to hold our children, to sit with our children, you know, to listen to their anger. I had a friend or colleague come up to me this week, a different colleague come up to me and said she'd read my book and that she said to one of her young children this week, after the child expressed anger, I feel honored that you would tell me. Thank you for telling me that you're angry with me. And the child was confused, didn't know what to do. And I love that. I love that she took that takeaway. That's healthy containing, healthy attachment. So again, another digression, but a point that I think lends itself to other ideas besides dialectical behavioral therapy. In stage two, moving from being emotionally shut down to experiencing emotions fully. So learning to deal with pain without the symptoms, talking, experiencing feelings, expressing themselves, right? We this is what we all hope for. That we can begin, that we can believe, and through the practice of these skills, that we can feel something uncomfortable and that we don't have to do something to take ourselves out of it, which in the end is going to cause greater suffering and problems. So we have some experience with it. We have some confidence, some mastery with these skills, some reinforcement. And then we get to this second stage. Stage three, building an ordinary life, solving ordinary life problems, dealing with life problems and challenges we all have. Sometimes you can move on to a different therapy, a different the dialectical behavior often is introduced or utilized at a more acute phase. So you might move on to a more traditional or a therapist with a different model at this point. Stage four is moving from incompleteness to completeness and connection, developing, a spiritual life, life direction, passions, you know, really expanding yourself beyond what that diagnosis defines you as. So it does have an optimistic, healing mentality or construct, right? It says that you can move beyond it. And Dr. Linehan, not only does she have professional experience with it, she also has personal experience. Learning to balance acceptance and behavior change. The balance between acceptance and change strategies in therapy from the fundamental dialectic that results in the treatment's name. Dialectic means weighing and integrating the contradictory facts of ideas with a view to resolving apparent contradictions. It's a very complicated way of saying that we can hold on to two things at the same time. And specifically with this, that we can encourage change, facilitate change in our clients, and at the same time demonstrate a therapeutic alliance that's built on unconditional positive regard. You know, I see the world through the lens of attachment so much. I have analytical training in my background. I'm also a family therapist by training. And so in analytical training, we talk about transference and countertransference. That is how the client sees us and then how we see or feel toward the client. And so when I talk about that with our therapists, when I train therapists, I'm talking about, you know, when you get frustrated, when you get upset, and I make this leap to parenting too, you've lost contact with the individual. They don't feel seen anymore. And so, you know, clients will ask me, or excuse me, my therapists and my staff will ask me, but we're paid to change. We're change agents. We facilitate, encourage, foster change. You know, we if we didn't improve symptoms in our clients, we wouldn't be doing our job. And my response is, this is how you do it. In other words, developing this kind of unconditional positive regard that Carl Rogers made famous is how you affect change. So it seems ironic. It seems counterintuitive, right? Most of where we get stuck as parents is we step in and try to control the child, specifically what they think and feel or want. Most obviously, we try to control their symptoms, their behaviors. And then we're asked to take a step back. We're asked to go to Al-Anon, where we work on ourselves. You know, the best way to shift the dynamic, often in relationships where there's resistance or a power struggle, is to work on yourself. You know, to write a letter, have a conversation and say, you know, I've been talking to my therapist or watching a webinar or reading a book, and I got encouraged to stop trying to focus on changing you and work on my own stuff that I have plenty to work on. In order to make that shift, we have to be somewhat free from guilt and shame, or that's going to be too overwhelming for us. But this is all in this idea of accepting the individual and at the same time encouraging change. It's that kind of dialectic. It's the dialectic that I talk about all the time of I can demonstrate healthy and assertive boundaries, and I can practice non-controlling in my relationships. I can let go and be at the same time more active and assertive in my lives and in relationships. The non-judgmental consideration is really, really critical for people. If we don't do that, that therapeutic alliance is fractured. And most importantly, we are recreating the variables, the context where the individual was hurt in the first place. Speaking of validation and listening, one thing it is not, and I talk about this all the time, it came up in a parent meeting last night in Orange County, is that it's not agreement. It's not condoning something. It's just understanding. And again, we're afraid to validate feelings because we think we're condoning. We think we're giving permission. We think all bets are off. There are no guardrails anymore. But as I talk about all the time, that's often the way to get the child to take one step closer toward you, to take one piece of their armor off, one brick of their wall, their defense down, is to understand and validate. And it takes courage. on our part. As professionals, as parents, as spouses, it takes courage. It takes strength to do that. Staying alert to the other person. You know, always trying to find them. I talk about that in my book, that story where a therapist was sharing with me that she had a client that would sometimes grew up in a rural farm in Germany where there was a river that ran on the edge of the farm. And sometimes the client, this was analytical type of therapy, sometimes the client was talking about present day challenges, dilemmas, issues, relationships, and sometimes they would drift back and forth seamlessly between the past and the present. And one day while listening to the story, the therapist had this sensation. She said, "I knew we were talking about her childhood because I could smell the river on the farm where she grew up." And that's a beautiful image to talk about, this idea of, can we smell the river? And having that experience. You know, I was thinking today while I was walking through the airport, I almost want to introduce a new word into the emotional lexicon. You know, we talk about emotions, happy, sad, mad, glad, scared, embarrassed, anxious, those type of emotions. And I almost want the word found to be an emotion. What it feels like to feel found. It's the sweetest experience. And feeling found is only possible when there's no judgment. My daughter said to me at one point when she came back from doing some of her work that I didn't understand her. And I was thinking to myself, I'm pretty good at diagnosing and seeing somebody, right? I can analyze somebody, their symptoms, their behaviors, their strengths, their weaknesses. I was thinking she was wrong, but what she was saying was, I didn't feel understood. It's a much more nurturing, grace-filled experience than being diagnosed. And when we understand somebody, all of their behavior, no matter how pathological, makes perfect sense. And we steer away from or avoid trying to solve problems. We use language, the skills that I use, we use language like, I have a thought, or I have an idea, or what if you tried this? What would it be like, right? That kind of language, and it's not just semantics, presents itself as, I'm not right, you're not wrong. This isn't simple to solve, just an idea. It allows it to kind of be floated out there, and they can pick and choose, right? Because clients, people, children, have the experience in their background, in their traumas, with having no control. So to take over, to be controlling, even in a therapy session, is going to re-trigger, re-traumatize the individual. So we hold on loosely to our solutions. And then if the person isn't ready for it, and they say something like, well, that's a stupid idea, or that won't work, we easily, effortlessly back off and saying, maybe you're right, I don't know. And then we ask more questions to understand. We treat them as emotionally equal. I think I've thought about this, of course, having been trained as a marriage and family therapist for many, many years, because in family therapy, they talk about hierarchy, like the executive system, the parenting system. You have, in some ways, more rights, more decision-making. It's not a democracy. You're not voting with your two-year-old about what you're going to have for dinner, right? You find clever ways and creative ways to negotiate, but it's not a democracy. So in that way, they're not equal. But in an emotional sense, there is an equality. Being cruel to a child, especially when we're supposed to be the more mature ones, the ones with the more solid, grounded sense of self, is not okay. So talk about that kind of equality. And then this dialectic, everybody is doing the best they can, and they can do better. More about to take home, you know, there's an evolution of theory. In early in any theory, the proponents of that theory are often very zealous and rigid. And so while I think Linehan's model is a very specific model, and to call yourself a DBT program, you have to follow specific prescriptive steps and schedules and so forth. You even have to respond to their training in a certain way to call yourself that. But even though that's true, we can also borrow from it in all of our therapies and even in our parenting. Learning to become flexible and eclectic doesn't mean we're without theory. That means that we're informed. And again, I had a father say last night when he was talking about his child, he made this point. He said, you know, I learned in my own work that I couldn't parent my child like my father parented me. It's a different time, different situation. And most importantly, it's a different child. Understanding your strengths and weaknesses, you know, knowing for yourself what the difference between what you need and what your child needs and what you can use help with, adjusting to the client, being able to adapt to them, to not hold on so tightly to your concepts, to your ideas, to your theories, to your model, to your truth, that you leave no space for the other. Learning when to value the process instead of the outcome. So much of what we talk about is that. We talk about this theory is best in single gender situations. The war story is an example of embracing the symptom for what it is, right? The war story is a letter that your child writes that talks about how fun it was to do whatever they were doing that got them sent here, right? We want to run with that, understand it. It's we validate that, and that validation opens it up so that we can encourage and facilitate change instead of shutting it down. When we're doing sessions out in the field, we're working on assignments, and sometimes the session discussion takes on a whole different quality. So each week is not the same. Sometimes we're talking about letters that you've written or that they've written to you. Sometimes we're going over assignments, and sometimes we're talking about the relationship, the process, the here and now. The staff relationships are the research, much of the research has shown us the most important thing that students identify, clients identify as creating change. And this goes along with everything that we're talking about. Things change too from the early part of the program to the late part. We adapt not only for individuals, but where they are at in the process. Other programs tell us that it's hard to maintain the same kind of dynamic that our clients and students start off with at Evoke, right? It's hard to maintain that. It's a very rich, powerful process. And that's become our thought process, my thought process for the past 20 plus years, is how do we take what I found to be the most magical dynamic process and how do we borrow from that? Because this in some ways is going to be the easiest, safest place for most of your kids, for their whole lives. But what can we learn from it? How can it inform us? Same with DBT. I talk about this idea about dealing with idiots. You know, I remember when I was a new therapist, I saw myself as a sort of a detective, right? You know, clients would come, students would come, and they would say, my parents are this, my parents are that, my teachers are this or that. And I found myself trying to figure out really early on, like, how true is that? How accurate is that? And that left. But I had this technique that I would use subsequently where I would say to the client, I would say, well, you're an idiot too. And they would look at me like, what's this guy saying? And then I'd say, no, I'm an idiot. And your parents are idiots. And really, this life is about how we learn to deal with all the idiots that are out there. How are you going to? And you're going to come up against some doozies. In psychology, they call it the equivalent of that idiot intervention that I would use is called an other. It is hard to be with an other, right? That's why marriage is so hard. That's why parenting is so hard. That's why being a child to a parent is so hard. You know, when the clients would say to me, well, I'm doing fine in all my relationships except for with my family or my parents, I would say, that's easy. If you can't get along with your friends, you're really struggling. But getting along with family, getting along with another is hard. All right, I'm happy to take any questions. The first question is, there seems to be so much commonality between DBT and 12-step treatment. Dr. Reedy, do you see this? I love this question, and I want to say this. I got actually asked to go out. This summer, I'm going to be speaking, co-presenting, co-facilitating a parenting weekend for another program with a Buddhist monk. And I was talking with the person designing the program, and I said, that's so wonderful, because if we can teach parents through two or three languages, when you can understand the same concepts through various languages, I call it being bilingual or multilingual, then you really get it. When you can see the commonalities between DBT, 12 steps, Al-Anon, addiction, cognitive behavioral, self-psychology, attachment theory, ACT therapy. You know, when you start to, you say, well, I hear more similarities than differences. That means that you get it. When early on in our education, this goes for all of us, early on in our education or exposure to these concepts, we are very rigid. We're very literal. We're metaphorically impaired. Right? We don't understand the concept. So we rely very heavily on the specific language in which it was taught. But when we understand the concept, then the work at Evoke lends itself well to a follow-up sober living environment or 12-step program. Even if that was not a major part of your child's exposure here at Evoke. So absolutely, very, very nice insight and a credit to you, really. Any other questions before I go over upcoming events announcements? I have another slide at the end that has space for questions. All right, I'll go over the upcoming announcements, kind of our housekeeping, and then I'll open it up again for questions. And please stay on, because the next webinar needs your help, needs your attention. We want all parents to go to 6 12-step support groups, specifically one of the following or all of the following. You can go to one. If you don't like the meeting, go to another one. If you hear somebody at a meeting that you like, that sounds wise, that you're attracted to what they're saying, go up to them and ask them what other meetings that they like. So Al-Anon, you can go to alanon.org. CODA, go to coda.org. FamiliesAnonymous.org, naranon.org, or Alateen. You can go to alanon.alateen.org. That's for teenagers. You can also go to nami.org, N-A-M-I.org, to find free classes, resources, education there. Please subscribe to our podcast. Go to the podcast app on your iOS device, your iPhone device, and search Evoke Therapy Programs. Or if you have an Android device, go to download the SoundCloud app and do the same search, Evoke Therapy Programs. You can subscribe, you can download them, you can listen to them on the train when you don't have connectivity. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for more inspirational quotes, ideas, and pictures. On Facebook for articles and other things that we share. Search Evoke Therapy Programs on Facebook. The Second Nature Alumni Foundation on Facebook is an alumni foundation of former parents from Evoke and other programs that talks about or that helps people who can't afford therapy. And then go to our blog. Like I said, my new blog comes out tomorrow. We had a wonderful blog posted today from a professional who attended our program at a professional event. Go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com to buy my book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent. The Parent Alumni Foundation book page on Amazon through the Amazon Smiles program means that a percentage of the proceeds of the regularly priced books that are recommended by our therapists, that goes to the charity to help people who can't afford therapy. I'm going to be in New York next week on the 3rd. I'll be in Toronto the following week on the 10th. Seattle on the 17th, Chicago on the 23rd, and then again back in New York on the 7th. I'm going to put a June Los Angeles group on the schedule here in the next week. For intensives and workshops, we want all families to go to a workshop if they can while their child is with us. Talk to your therapist. You can coordinate with a field visit to your child if it's appropriate clinically. May 20 and 27th and 28th is the next one. The next Finding You is obviously happening right now and is not open anymore. Finding You, the next Finding You is going to be outdoors in the Oasis. So May 28th through 31st. If you want to attend that, that's for any adult. That's deeper work, 6 individuals, myself running it and some other staff, and going into deep family of origin, your own attachment issues, and how that impacts current day relationships. Contact Gail at evoketherapy.com for more information about the workshops. and contact intensives at evoketherapy.com for more information about the intensives. Pursuits is our high adventure trips for families or young adults. Therapy Light, adventure therapy. You can mix in some therapy with it, or you can just have the therapeutic staff running really fun adventures of any kind all over the world. All right, no other questions have come in. This is what I need from you. This is the help I need. We want to do one sibling webinar per month to support siblings. So this webinar is for siblings and about siblings. So you and your family can attend. You can ask questions about dealing with other siblings besides the ones that are at Evoke or have been through Evoke. Or you can also have the sibling themselves attend the webinar and ask questions. You can have them, you can present questions for them. Okay, so the next one will be this Monday, May 1st. I don't know where I'll be broadcasting from because for a few days I'll be homeless, but it'll be interesting to find out. So that'll be at 7 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time on Monday, May 1st. So please submit anything ahead of time or during that you want help with. All right, folks, I hope this point of contact is helpful. Thanks for joining me this evening. We have really good attendance tonight. Take care, and I'll talk to you Monday night. Bye-bye.